Hello and welcome to the Society for Acute Medicine's podcast. Here we discuss topics, cases, and anything new and upcoming in the world of acute medicine. This is our view and take. Remember to always do your own reading around the topics we discuss. Enjoy!
Hello everybody and welcome to part two of iron deficiency anemia. I must be honest, I didn't think that iron deficiency anemia would be a part one, part two when I first started looking at it, but actually it's a really meaty guideline and we've gone into a fair bit of depth. So instead of doing a 2 hour long podcast, we thought we'd be kind and split it into two. So I've got the lovely Damien Dewey with me.
Hi Vicky.
And I've got the equally lovely Peter Ng with me.
I was waiting for you to leave out the equally lovely. Thanks.
No, I'm being nice today. But unfortunately, we won't call him equally lovely because he's ditched us. But Mike Weebles had to go and save some lives on the ward. So there's just us three for this bit. So let's make a start. So we've talked about iron deficiency anemia and the investigations of it and the definitions and diagnosis of it. And we're now going to look at follow-up, and who better to take us through that than the lovely Dr. Dewey.
Thank you, Vicky. So I was talking about follow-up, and I found it a bit strange that we're talking about follow-up before we even start about treatments. But the guidance has it a bit earlier on, so we're going to go on as per the guidance. So follow-up, who do we follow up, how do we follow up, and what other investigations potentially are necessary for patients? So how often do we do blood tests on patients after they've had a normal hemoglobin, they've been on iron for a while? When should we repeat the test? And the guidelines suggest that potentially every 6 months, and it says perhaps as well, they use the word perhaps every 6 months initially. In the smaller print, it does suggest checking potentially at 3 months, then 6 months, 12 months, and then 24 months. Most patients, though, it does say that are on iron replacement therapy. Most patients do normalize their iron stores, their iron profile goes back to normal, and the hemoglobin as well returns to normal. But in the minority, so small case of patients that are on iron treatment, don't always recover from their iron deficiency and can have recurrent iron deficiencies as well. Obviously, we have to think about the compliance with some of these medications, because as we all know, I'm sure, is that iron tablets aren't the nicest of tablets to take and can cause some lovely side effects, especially in older patients as well. And they mightn't always want to take their iron tablets. So it's making sure that compliance is sorted. Then if we have done all our tests, we've done the OGDs, colonoscopies, we've looked for everything, and they still have ongoing iron deficiency anemia, which is persistent or recurrent, and they've ongoing symptoms such as weight loss or abdominal pains, it's thinking about what other investigations to do. And some of the things that they do suggest is potentially repeating the bi-directional endoscopy. So doing another OGD, doing another colonoscopy. And then moving on from that, it's thinking about other investigations. And I think this is where it goes beyond the scope of acute medicine. And more than likely, we've referred these patients on to our gastroenterology team. But it's always nice to know what we're asking our gastroenterology team to be thinking about or doing. And what they suggest is having a look at the small bowel and doing further investigations off that. And that can include doing capsule endoscopies, CT or MRI enterographies. And then after that, thinking about other causes outside the bowels. So have we done an ultrasound or a CT of the renal tracts, looking for those potential renal malignancies or bladder malignancies as well. And then thinking about the long term, how long should patients be on iron tablets for? And Vicky and Peter, how long would you normally keep patients on iron tablets for? Would you keep them on it for life? Would you, whenever they come in, do you stop them? Do you think the GP should be thinking about stopping patients on iron? As we know, it's not the nicest of drugs. What do you think, Peter?
Yeah, so I think as an acute medic, I think that's out of my remit. I have no idea. I've always handed this back to the GP to monitor, and I asked the GP to think about a stop date, I'll be honest, or I don't even mention it more realistically.
So I love stopping tablets, and especially things like iron, which are horrible anyway. But I think there's a big caveat here, which is what we found, what we've done. So if we've got somebody who's iron deficient, then we've found a big ulcer sitting there, which is going to heal, then I will put a stop date on it. Or certainly if I see somebody who comes in on iron, if I've got time, and we've talked about time quite a lot on this podcast already, I would be looking at, you know, why they were started on it. I know there's a lot of patients that continue on iron for a while, don't they, or long term. And if they're settled on it and it's keeping their HB controlled, then fine. But if there was a direct cause, then I'd be wanting to stop it. So certainly I had to have it after my third child, and I couldn't wait to stop it. It was horrible. So, and I was no longer bleeding, obviously, at that point. So for me, it was, I think I was advised to take it for a month, but as soon as my HB was getting there, stopped it, ditched it, preferred the spinach.
Because that's interesting, thinking about how you stop the cause of the iron deficiency anemia. And if you've stopped the cause, then why are we still replacing iron if it's not necessarily needed? If you're not necessarily losing it as well.
Yeah, the people you see on it chronically are the people, you often see it on some of the renal patients, don't you? And then also those patients who've got iron deficiency anemia that we haven't really found the cause for, and they're a bit too frail to investigate, and it's just on there. But yeah, if I can stop it, I think I would. And yeah, putting a stop date or a review date on it is quite a nice thing to make the GP aware. Yeah, I like stopping tablets.
Probably do it too much. That's a good thing of flagging them up to the GP. Oh, we've started them on iron tablets. Can you please review 6 months? Because these follow ups and reviews of hemoglobin and iron profiles, they're at 6 months. That's primary care. These should be followed up in the primary care setting. We shouldn't be bringing these patients back near a hospital unless it's required. And follow-up of iron tests isn't something that we necessarily need to be bringing back to a hospital setting. As long as we've investigated that we've talked about in part one of this podcast. But I do know that I've mentioned the word iron tablets quite a lot, which is a treatment. So I do think we need to move on to the treatment section now, because that's a big part. Peter, I'm going to hand over to you now.
Sure. I mean, you say it's a big part, but treatment of iron deficiency is just give them iron, isn't it? It's as simple as the diagnosis of iron deficiency anemia. you're right. If only it was that simple. This can be a fairly big topic, I suppose. Yeah, the treatment is to give them iron, and a first-line treatment would be all iron. And you would start this as soon as possible, or as practically possible, with the exception if they're going to have colonoscopy within 2 weeks, because all iron can obscure your views. Iron doesn't affect views on an OGD, however, and what I didn't know is that it doesn't affect CT colonography as well. I assumed you'd have to stop it for CT colonography, but apparently not. So that was interesting. The guidance talks a lot about the frequency of dosing the oral iron, and I'm pleased to see that it now recommends once daily is just as good, essentially. Having it more than once daily just increases your side effect profile.
I remember seeing this on Twitter, but I think it was at least a year ago, it might be even 2 years ago, that this started to sort of be the thing that you don't need to do as many iron tablets per day. But I still see people all the time on 2 or 3 doses of iron a day, don't you guys? And I love it. It's a good teaching point, I think, which I also like saying, and don't take it with your cup of tea, and do take it with some fresh orange. Although I can't see the orange, the bit C in the guidance anymore, so I don't know if
I thought that as well. I was expecting to read something about vitamin C and couldn't see it at all.
Yeah.
So I wonder whether I should not mention that in the future, because I tell them to take it with a glass of orange juice, which is, interesting. I'm not sure if I should be doing that. What I don't tell them, which I probably should do, is that they shouldn't take it with food in general, because it can reduce the bioavailability by 75%. But there's, with regards to the frequency of the dosing, there's a bit of science behind it. So if your gut absorbs iron, your hepcidin levels increase, and that inhibits subsequent absorption of your iron for the next 24 hours by 35 to 45%. So it just makes any subsequent dosing in that day less efficient. And so you're going to be more prone to side effects. So there's a bit of science behind spreading out the frequency of the dosing. And it goes on to say that you can even consider alternate day dosing of all iron as well. So there's some limited data saying that even that might be better. So if your patient's not tolerating once daily, consider alternate day dosing before considering it to failure. So I think when we talk about all iron, I suppose we talk about how effective is it. And the paper says that just over 70% have a hemoglobin rise of over 10 grams per liter within 2 weeks, or 20 grams per liter within 4 weeks. And failure to achieve this is predictive of failure of the treatment to achieve a sustained hematological response to the all iron. And it's then you may consider the next step. But before talking about the next step, it does list the different types of iron salts. Do you guys have a preference what iron salt you use?
Well, not really a preference. I've just always gone for ferrous sulfate just because I always have. But are you going to tell me that's not as good?
No. Ferrous sulfate is my number one just purely because I know the dose. And I don't have to reach for the BNF to remember the dose of ferrous fumarate or the other salts. It's probably the cheapest one, I think. Looking at there's a nice table there that tells you how much elemental iron is in each tablet and blah, blah, blah. And it gives you the price breakdown. Ferrous sulfate is one of, if not the cheapest option there. So I think I'm going to stick with ferrous sulfate on a personal level anyhow. Yeah, so the next step would be IV iron. So we'd consider... Okay, Damien. See, you got your
I'm
hand
loving
up there.
The fact Damien can't wait in. To get in here. Yeah.
just before you move on to the IVs part of stuff, ferrous fumarate, but it does come in a liquid though, which sometimes is a bit nicer to patients. I don't think the sulfate one comes in liquid, does it?
Comes in drops, apparently.
Drops.
Which I've never prescribed before.
Although drops are £60.
Yes,
£60 for drops. My goodness, that is expensive. I won't be prescribing that. But there is a liquid one if it's easier to get down NG tubes. No, you can't put it down NG tubes, can you? Ooh. Oh, that's something I'll have to look up now. There's something about iron down NG tubes, isn't there?
And Damien's just volunteered to put that on the show notes.
It will be in the show notes afterwards. But if people have swallowing difficulties and can't swallow tablets, ferrous fumarate might be an easier one for us.
No, you're right. I think that's where I have gone off my own rule and prescribed ferrous fumarate is when I need the liquid formulation.
I'll let you get back to the one that I see quite often, the next. IV.
All right, okay. IV iron is that. Okay, so IV iron. So this would be your second line treatment if there's no response to oral iron or there's been significant side effects to oral iron or there's issues with compliance, which inevitably quite often is. And I can see Vicky's itching to say something.
Well, I thought this was what Damien was, because I'm sitting on my hands a bit here. Do you think this is honestly what happens, or in your experience, is everybody just shoved on IV iron straight away because they're anemic and we're going to avoid a blood transfusion? But I think we really overuse it. And when you're looking at the cost, you know, and actually what was really interesting looking at this paper was the efficacy and that it isn't that beneficial compared to oral iron. And I don't think we give people a trial of oral iron very much. Damon's laughing. Absolutely. I'm not sure if he's just laughing at me or just in general.
No, because you know me too well. And I did want to say that, but I wanted Peter to talk about iron, IV iron first. Yeah, I'll jump in about. But you've said it second line. So often do I see it being given first. And I'm like, oh, why then iron? Why then IV iron? I haven't even tried oral. So I do find it quite hard. But as Vicky says, the paper does say that the efficacy isn't as good or isn't great. And do we just find it easier just to put up a half an hour, 15 minute bag of iron and let the patient go home without thinking about the potential drug risks and the adverse risks that can come with giving iron as well? And from what I was aware of, if you're given IV iron, you have to have a doctor in the area just in case. Do we warn our patients that when we're given iron, that this potentially can cause adverse reactions?
No, I think you both raise a good point. I think IV iron, I agree, is very overused. And I think there's a big misconception as well amongst patients and clinicians that you give iron directly to the bloodstream, your HB is going to correct quicker than having all iron, when that is not true. They both correct your HB equally as fast. So it doesn't fix the problem any quicker. But you're right, yeah, we don't counsel our patients very well with regards to IV iron. Some IV depends on, I think it depends on the IV iron formulation. So some of them require a test dose because there's a higher risk of hypersensitivity reactions. They all have a risk of hypersensitivity reactions, infusion reactions. And some of those preparations are higher risk than others. But yeah, it's really expensive. I was looking at the price of the one we use in my trust. It's £150 to replete iron.
Is that equivalent to a certain number of tablets or?
So I think it was a 28-day course of ferrous sulfate was £1.
Wow.
Yeah, that's wow.
That's a difference, isn't it?
Yeah. I think what we should just mention about IV iron is that it can be first line for certain patients, and I won't go into detail about that because I think that will be touched on in the next section about special circumstances. But if your patient doesn't absorb very well for whatever reason, then you might consider just skipping the oral iron, and I think that is perfectly fine. I think we'd all agree with that, despite our love for oral iron these days. What I wasn't aware of is ferric maltol. I've never heard of this before, but the guidance talks about this as a new preparation for iron deficiency anemia of any cause, and it's particularly useful for inactive inflammatory bowel disease and those who haven't tolerated oral iron previously. There's less element iron in there, and therefore there's slow normalization of your hemoglobin, but the side effects are just as are comparable to placebo. So it's very well tolerated. The downside is that it's more expensive. With being a new drug, it's just under £50 for 28 days compared to £1 for ferrous sulfate, as we mentioned, but it's still cheaper than the IV iron. So fair cheaper with the IV iron we use in my trust. So I wonder whether I should be speaking to my local pharmacist about whether we have this available or whether it should be an option for us going forward. I think we'd probably also mention that red blood cell transfusion is always an option as well. But obviously this is only for certain circumstances, those with severe symptoms of anemia. So those with ischemic sign, chest pain, heart failure, that kind of thing. Or if they're hemodynamically compromised with low blood pressure, you may well consider it then. And let's not forget there is some iron in blood transfusions. There's equivalent of 200 milligrams of elemental iron in one unit. And so those patients will still need some sort of iron replacement following that. Vicky, do you want to jump in?
Yeah, so I was just going to say I've had juniors a bit worried about prescribing iron after a blood transfusion because they've been worried that they're getting too much iron. But especially with the sort of new guidance on alternate day or daily iron, it does a nice little flow chart, doesn't it? And it just says to just start iron straight away so you don't have to wait and you don't have to worry about getting too much iron, which is something I've been asked about in the past.
No, you're right. I'm a fan of starting iron straight after blood transfusions. Damien?
I think our listeners need to know as well, Vicky, that hopefully we're going to have a talk about blood transfusions at some stage in the future as well.
We are.
Yes. So that's a completely different topic, but and it's quite a good topic, especially nowadays when we do have a blood shortage. So yeah,
we can use
this opportunity to tell our listeners to go and donate blood.
Yeah, no,
use
that's
this
a good
opportunity.
Point.
Yeah, this yeah. Is the okay. Thing. Please do donate blood if you can.
Yeah, we're on an amber alert, and at one point there was more blood in hospitals than there was actually in the big storage depots. So we are in a bit of a pickle with blood donations. So if you were somebody who used to donate before the pandemic and then sort of lost the habit of it, go and donate. And if you've never donated, think about it. So yeah, no, thank you, Damien. That is a useful time for me to plug that. But yeah, there's hope. I'm sorting out a podcast as we speak, looking at that, because there was an excellent talk on SAM, but it was one of the ones that wasn't recorded, so even if you've been, you can't listen back to it. So we shall solve that problem by doing a lovely podcast on it.
Great, thanks for that plug. I'll look forward to that episode. Right, going back to treatment,
you'll probably be recording it with me too.
That's all right. I always take pleasure in your company, Vicky, so that's okay. What happens if your patient doesn't respond to iron replacement? I think we then need to keep an open mind about what else might be going on. I think the most common reason is often non-compliance, particularly for oral iron tablets. So that certainly needs exploring, but your patient may not be absorbing the iron as well. And that's what, as I mentioned, that is an indication to move on to IV iron. But there may be other factors at play. So there might be systemic inflammatory diseases that might impair hematopoiesis. There might be bone marrow pathology, hemolysis, continued bleeding. And as we'd mentioned in part one, we would always be checking B12 and folate levels to make sure there isn't a concurrent deficiency there. Right, I think I've talked enough. Shall I hand this over to Damien to talk about special circumstances?
How rude, it's me.
We like listening to me, but it is Vicky, to be fair.
Yes. We keep getting us all mixed up. Sorry, Vicky.
So very special circumstances, very special people are young women, which we've already established that I still am now they've changed the guidelines. So young women, I think we do this well and badly. So I think it is often down to menstruation and also diet. So if there's vegans or vegetarians, it's worth just going through the diet. So 5 to 12% of young women will be have an iron deficiency anemia, and it often will not be anything that needs investigation. However, celiac screen, really important. So I think everybody takes a menstrual history, but not everybody does a celiac screen. So we should be thinking about that. And then, you know, young women sadly can still get other things such as cancers, but actually also ulcers. So we do need to sometimes think about it. So it's just about what is always important in acute medicine, really good history and examination. It comes back to our, you know, it's core skills, doesn't it? Young men, it's uncommon. So you really do need to investigate those as usual. Elderly, we've already talked about this, anemia is common, and you just need to really think about the risks and benefits of treatment. So it goes on to say 20% of the over 85s will have an iron deficiency anemia. 50% of those in care homes are anemic. And that's a huge statistic, isn't it? I had to read that twice. And anemia is very much linked to frailty as well. So it's really important, if they have got it, to treat it. Investigate it will be another point. But Damien, you've got your hand up, you're bouncing off the seat.
I just wanted to confirm, Vicky, when you said 50% with anemia, is that all anemias or iron deficiency?
I read anemia? It as anemia. So 50% of those in care homes. I read it as, because it would be, yeah. So I read it as 50% of those in care homes have got anemia. And I think it's
still quite a lot, isn't it?
Yeah, so I think it must be those. Do you know what? We can make sure we put that correctly in the show notes, because it does seem a lot. And I don't know if it's 50% of those getting admitted from care homes are anemic rather than 50% of people in care homes. Does that make sense?
Oh, I didn't even think about that bit.
Yeah, but it's still a huge statistic. It got my red pen out, that bit did, as something that is important and really important to treat, isn't it? So, like we've talked a lot about the investigations and do we, don't we? But actually, treating it is easier, and it will increase their frailty. So, that was an important one. CKD, I tend to leave this to the nephrologist, because when the CKD is bad enough that they start to run into the anemia territory, they're nearly always under a nephrologist, and it's whether they need EPO. and a bit of iron. And I think that's outside my specialty input. I don't know if you two agree with that. Damien's nodding, so I'll take that as a yes. So CCF, that's another time that I've thought about that more recently, actually, that a lot of patients with heart failure tend to have iron deficiency anemia. And again, it can really help if we treat them, because it can improve their prognosis. And as Peter alluded to, a lot of the time IV iron can be used for a benefit there as well in those patients. Inflammatory bowel disease, again, I would imagine that the majority of the time this is being led by the specialties. So our gastroenterology colleagues in this case, a third of those patients will have iron deficiency, but it's also commonly accompanied by a B12 and folate deficiency as well. So I suspect we just need to look for it, but these patients should be under the care of a gastroenterologist. And as Damien said when he was talking about causes, patients following GI surgery will often have a iron deficiency anemia secondary to malabsorption. So that's worth, if we've got a patient who's got it, it's just worth knowing what surgery they've had. So that leads us on to the end of the guideline. Probably worth, we summarised at the end of the last one, but, you know, top take-home points, Damien?
Ooh, on the spot. From the whole thing or just from part two?
Whatever you want. Whatever
I like, okay. Yeah. Ooh, I'm going to have to think about that. They think about who to investigate, who not to investigate. They are our older patients, if it's appropriate. Obviously, put my thinking cap on for that. Obviously, discussing it with them as well.
Yeah, well, I liked Peter's point a lot about the thinking about the CT colonoscopy, because that does tend to be the, oh, they're not well enough for a colonoscopy, they're really frail, we'll do a CT colonoscopy. And actually, that's really made me think, because it isn't that benign an investigation, is it?
Mm. So yeah, so that's a good take-home message as well. The list of causes, so it's not just get an OGD colonoscopy and thumbs up, away you go. Thinking about other things and thinking outside the box as well. And obviously, first line is iron tablets, not IV iron. And that's a big take-home message.
Peter, what about you?
So I'll limit my learning points from just this episode. And I would say ferric maltol. I've never heard of ferric maltol, and it's intrigued me. And I think it could well be a good replacement for IV iron, potentially. So that's something I'm going to go back to and speak to my local pharmacist about. And just knowing when IV iron is indicated, and particularly for those special circumstances. So looking at heart failure in particular, because I think that's something that we see quite frequently, and we could potentially be giving IV iron as an acute medic to those patients.
I just wanted to say earlier, when Vicky mentioned that as well, our heart failure nurses are great at picking up iron deficiency and getting patients plugged in for IV iron. So they're great at it. It's a big shout out to them as well, our heart failure nurses, if they're listening.
So I've just got the guideline up again, and it isn't that clear looking at this about that. So the statement is 20% of those over 85 are anemic, and more than 50% of residential/nursing home residents. So that there's a reference that we could look up for the show notes, but that it does seem a huge number, isn't it? So I'm going to think about the there's loads of different points as we've gone through, and I just mentioned one of them there that Peter said about that's really stuck with me, that the CT colonoscopy. But a third of patients over the age of 50 with iron deficiency anemia will have some sort of bleeding, mostly in the sort of bowel or the stomach. And a third of those, it will be due to cancer. So I think that's the thing we know. And when we see somebody with an iron deficiency anemia, it was sort of our instincts go towards sort of looking for that. But then I think I also got really struck when Damien was looking through those causes, because I think that's something that I don't do. I just immediately go to they must be bleeding into their gut. And yes, that is probably the most common thing. But as an acute physician, I should be thinking about the whole picture, shouldn't I? So I know that goes back to the first episode, but that's probably the thing that stuck with me the most.
Yeah, one other thing I did want to mention was, we discussed it before recording this, was about phosphate. And the reason we haven't gone into it is because it was such a woolly bit in the guidance of whether we should be checking phosphate in patients when we give them IV iron, as it can lower, IV iron can lower the phosphate. And actually there was an MRHA alert out about this. So I think just in brief, really, that's just to be aware of that and just think about it in those patients who are at risk.
So I think probably time to wrap up. Thank you very much, you two. And I look forward to meeting you again on another episode.
Thank you, Vicky.
Cheers. Thank you.
Thanks, Peter.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Thank you for listening to another episode of the Society of Acute Medicine podcast. We hope this episode has been interesting and helpful for you all. Please do go to the SAM website, www.acutemedicine.org.uk, for all things acute medicine, including show notes from today's episode under the education menu. You'll also find more info about acute medicine, the team, and how to contact us individually. Please do get in touch with us via Twitter using @acutemedpod and let us know what you thought, as well as topics you'd like us to explore in future episodes, or if you would love to get involved. Thanks again for listening, and we hope you join us next time.